Thriving, Not Surviving, with your host, Gina Gardner. To lead others, you first need to be the best version of yourself and lead from a place of wholeness. Motivation, empowerment, leadership, personal and spiritual development are just a few of the topics you will hear on Thriving, Not Surviving. So sit back and enjoy the show with your host, Gina Gardner.
Hello there. I'm really pleased today to welcome Michael Cahill. Michael Cahill is an expert in his field, and I've known him for many years. In fact, we trained in neuro-linguistic programming together in 2005-06. I'm going to read you Michael's bio. As you know, I tend to read them because then I can make sure that I've got all of the richness of their experience. And Michael brings with him a huge wealth of experience. Michael Cahill is a trainer, coach, and facilitator who blends a rich and deep knowledge of NLP, systemic coaching, time to think, and the Enneagram with his considerable experience of business and investment to inspire change, growth, and transformation. He spent 16 years in the city as an equity analyst and is the author of the highly acclaimed The Financial Times Guide to Making the Right Investment Decisions. This understanding of investment, combined with an extensive knowledge of coaching and systems, allows him to work effectively facilitating workshops, teaching NLP and systemic coaching, as well as one-to-one coaching. Welcome, Michael. Thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for the kind introduction.
My pleasure. And it's my hope that you're going to join us because you've got so many things that you can share with us which are going to be really valuable. But today, we're going to talk about coherence between the left and right brain and how leadership requires both. So for the benefit of people who are on this program, some of whom may be very familiar with this, but others not understand at all what you're talking about, do you want to give us an outline of what you mean when you talk about coherence with left and right brain?
Yeah, firstly, let's just give a little background on what each hemisphere does.
Lovely.
So the left hemisphere is known for being linear, logical, sequential. It is, if you like, the rational part of our brain. It's very, very analytical. And one of the other characteristics it has is that it's also where language exists. So our capacity to use words, to put things into language, is more strongly in the left hemisphere.
Okay.
And obviously that's vitally important. You know, in business, you know, analysis, thinking of concepts, ideas, expressing those ideas, communicating those ideas. And so what I'm trying to encourage us to consider is that the left hemisphere is indeed very important, but we've tended to over-rely on it. Mm-hmm. And the other things that the left hemisphere tends to have, which can become challenges, is that it tends to really want certainty.
Yep.
And it likes to stick with what it knows. So it really likes familiarity.
Okay.
And the other thing is, of course, is that what the left hemisphere, whilst it can speak and it's got this language capability, it's less good at seeing what's going on. Because it's the right hemisphere, which is all about awareness rather than analysis, that has the capacity to see. So our senses we experience through our right brain.
Okay.
And, you know, it's no accident that the right brain is actually slightly bigger than the left.
Right.
And it's also connected through the vagus nerve with the heart brain and the gut brain. So to the extent that leadership is all about leading hearts and minds, and notice it is that order, leading hearts and minds, it's the right hemisphere that is connected to the heart brain. And so anything around values, for example, and relationship, and being in relationship, is very much right brain. And I think increasingly leadership requires the ability to be creative and innovative, which are right brain characteristics, because the right brain welcomes what's new.
Right.
It's looking out for what's new and different because it likes innovation, it likes change. So you can see there's a sort of almost like a tension between the left and right, between one really wanting certainty and one being very comfortable with uncertainty. And so it's, so when I'm talking about coherence, really what we're trying to do is have the two hemispheres communicating with one another so we don't become over-reliant on the left.
It's, when we've talked before, one of the things that really struck me is that in business currently, and I think you mentioned when we were talking before, that actually not just recently, but over the last few years, that there's been a great dependency on the left brain, on wanting things to be certain, on keeping within the framework of the known. And I wonder what your thoughts are about that.
I think it's a very understandable reaction to the level of uncertainty that we've had, particularly in the last 6 to 9 months.
Yeah.
And that acronym, which is originally, I understand, from the military, the VUCA acronym, volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity. That's the world that we have, you know, we've taken, it's just part of the landscape now. And leadership requires us to be not only familiar with that, but comfortable with it. And this is a challenge if we over-rely on the left hemisphere.
The challenge, I think, though, in terms of people's needing to feel certain about things, is that many people believe the illusion that is created by staying within your comfort zone, that it is known and it feels comfortable, therefore there is a sense that it's right. But the challenge with that is actually that we recirculate the same thinking that got us to the place that we want to move away from, and that within that comfort blanket, if you like, that it can become stultifying, particularly to creativity and to solution finding, because you're only using what you already have.
Yes, I'd agree with that. And I think it's that need familiarity is understandable. Yes. And it's a trap, because you can't keep things the way you want them to. Just look at many of our businesses this year and what's happened to them.
Yeah.
So that whole sense of how do we deal with this and how we lead from it, because that's another key point you've just identified, is that the left hemisphere will tend to think sequentially and in terms of cause and effect. There's a linearity to its thinking. So what it will try and do is it will try and identify what's the problem here. And of course, if you do that, you just end up, it's almost like going down the rabbit hole, getting more and more familiar with the problem, and you get into the state of the problem.
Yes.
Really, what the other aspect of this, which the left hemisphere has a tendency to do, not only does it have this pattern of thinking, it identifies with this thinking.
Can you just say what, perhaps explain what you mean by identify with that thinking?
Yeah,
that might be unfamiliar to people.
Yeah, this thinking is who I am.
Yeah.
And so again, with this thinking, we mistake for being who we are. But of course, who we are is much bigger than our thinking.
Yeah.
And so we've got this situation where we're problem focused, we're oriented towards the problem.
And presumably, if you have identified with that problem in the sense that you're talking about, you're less able to see any solutions, because in doing so, there's an implicit, if you're taking it in that way, criticism of yourself.
Yes. And that's why we might cling to something, is because we become defensive. I mean, they often talk about, you know, the three P's of the problem state, which is that the problem becomes permanent, pervasive, and personal.
Yeah.
You know, so it is, everything then becomes personal. And we know in business, it rarely is. It's not personal. And from a leadership perspective, that's a really important thing for your own sanity to bear in mind. And of course, you've talked about seeing the solution. The left hemisphere can speak, but it can't see. So it's the right hemisphere that really is interested in the solution, because the solution will come from what's new, what wants to emerge here. Yeah. How do we want to do this differently? But the solution isn't the opposite of the problem.
No. Before we move on, just want to, because I'm sure there are people who are listening to this who say, what do you mean you don't focus on the problem? How do you, can you sort a solution out if you don't focus on the problem? Now, my understanding is you're not saying that you don't need to identify what the problem is, but you don't stay there.
Exactly. The solution will come from a different state.
Yes, absolutely.
So you want to be in the state of the solution.
Yeah.
To find it. Because I think this is a really important point, because I think leadership is about what are the states you want to create.
Now, when I'm talking about this, one of the ways I demonstrate that is with a series of questions, and there'll be ones you're very familiar with, because I learnt them in the same program that you were doing. So what's your problem? How long have you been there? What caused it? And that, as you say, takes you down the rabbit hole of it's all about the problem. Whereas if what's your ideal solution? How do you think that you might get there? What experience can you use in the past that might help you get to the solution, and so on? There's a very different feel to those words, aren't there?
Yes. I mean, because you might ask the question differently. Well, how would you be as a person if this was no longer an issue in your life?
Yeah.
Completely different mindset. And I think the other aspect of the problem, and what the left hemisphere has a tendency to do, and this is a great way of knowing if you are in a state where you're relying on the left hemisphere, is that you will tend to lose perspective. Remember, I said the left hemisphere can't see. So you literally lose perspective. You will make a mountain out of a molehill. So those days where we just think, oh God, you know, this is going on and that's going on, and everything is becoming very big, we're likely to be over-relying on our left hemisphere. Furthermore, what tends to happen with the left hemisphere, because of its desire for certainty, it tends to deal in either or. Okay. Shall we do A or shall we do B? This is never a good decision-making frame for a leader, because two's a dilemma and three's choice. So either or is just not a state you want to be in when taking a decision. So you really need to be thinking of coming from the space of the solution and not trying to avoid the problem, but trying to move towards the solution. And it's that thing of, you know, we get what we focus on. So to the extent that a good example I sometimes use in my NLP classes is Tiger Woods, when he was asked about his weakest shot. You know, and I think leadership is about playing to your strength. So he was asked about his weakest shot being the bunker shot. And the journalist asked him, so you must spend a lot of time practicing that. And Tiger Woods quite correctly said, well, why on earth would I do that?
Yeah.
I spend more time practicing staying on the fairway. So he's deliberately framing it and focusing on what he wants from the golf shot is to be on the fairway.
Yeah.
Because if I stand on the tee and I'm looking at the bunker and I'm saying to myself, because this is the problem frame that you're referring to, whatever you do, don't go in the bunker. Don't go in the bunker. My whole physiology is now facing the bunker. And, you know, I'm likely to tighten up a little bit. You know, and anybody who plays sport, you know, people talk about being in flow. When they're at their best, they're in flow, etc. You're not going to do that by focusing on the problem.
It's interesting, isn't it? I can remember being told on our course that the brain does not compute the word don't. And that is why when you are driving along the road and there's you see a car that's crashed into the tree, and it's the only tree for miles around, and you think, well, why have they hit the tree? But it makes perfect sense if the brain is hearing the words don't hit the tree, but not computing the word don't. So instead of don't hit the tree, don't hit the tree, the brain's thinking, hit the tree, hit the tree.
Yeah.
And I think if parents understood that the children don't compute the word don't, they would have a very different way of bringing up their children. And I wish I'd had that in all of those years when I was a head teacher. I can hear myself saying, don't run along the corridor. And what I was doing is encouraging them to run along the corridor.
I think that's an important point. I think it's key for leadership.
Absolutely.
Because in leadership, you're trying to create a direction of travel.
Yes.
That is what you're looking to create, what you're moving towards, not what you're moving away from. And I think the other aspect of leadership where this is really, really relevant is that you're trying to create a state. And your language and the language you use creates state. Yes. So these things are really key. I remember using a football analogy, Steve McClaren was talking about England would want it to qualify for the European Championships in the early 2000s. You know, the language he used was, we must not lose this game. You know, and he's a very, very accomplished coach and manager and has got a very, very good club record and knows a lot about football. But just that importance of language.
But then you play a defensive game, don't you, rather an offensive game.
Well, I think you...
I know nothing about football, I have to tell you.
You know, it doesn't matter about the sport. You know, if this is your team that you're leading, you're creating pressure.
Yeah.
You know, we must not lose. You know, must is a pressure word. So I think it's... So what the right hemisphere will be much more drawn towards a solution. It will be much more creative. The right hemisphere will say, well, what's new here? What's different? So when we talk about uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity, the right brain can tolerate that.
Yes.
The left brain can't. And I think one of the things that a lot of leaderships have done, and some of you listening may recognize this, is often what can happen in organizations in a period of uncertainty is because we've got a period of uncertainty and the left brain craves certainty, is we create more goals and targets.
You can see that's been happening. I think since the last recession, particularly since 2008-09, I think we've seen much more bullish leadership where it's been, you've got to meet your targets. And I'm not saying that people shouldn't be encouraged to meet their targets, but it's been done to the exclusion of what works well. And certainly in terms of people's well-being and feeling that they have a value as human beings and a contribution to make, that it's almost dehumanized their sense of self.
Yes. And interestingly, you say that the left hemisphere tends to see the world as objects.
That makes sense then, doesn't it?
And we include our own body and regard our own body as an object. So we tend to not look after our body. And the left hemisphere, when it uses metaphor, all the metaphor is machine-based. So there's that sense of kind of regularity and machine-based language and goals and targets. What I would contend is that you've then got a conflict within many organisations, because often there's a conflict between the target and the values of the organisation. Yeah. And the values of the organisation are, of course, an expression of the heart brain. Mm-hmm. So what's important to us, our values, are heart-based. So, of course, that then connects with the right hemisphere, as I was saying earlier. And I think this is really interesting. You know, if you think of the linguistics of this, we talk about head office.
Yes.
Making decisions. But, you know, if you're compromising your values, you know, you've got all the reputational risk that goes with that. And you've also then got this state, I think, of fear within the organisation.
Yes.
If you take this kind of further and you're a leader who's into innovation and creativity and good relationships, which I think will be the hallmark of leaders in this environment, then you've got to be strong enough to say, well, actually, we need to really be considering our values in this decision, not the targets. Now, my background, as you said in the beginning, you know, I'm from a hard financial background. So I'm not saying targets are not important.
No, I think that's...
But what I'm saying is if you create an environment where your people are valued, where your values are honoured, where you really believe in your people, and where you're really, if you like, you've got a sense of purpose, of something that is beyond just you. And again, the left hemisphere is ego-based. So think about that when we start thinking about purpose. So purpose is almost right hemisphere, and values are right hemisphere. So we've got this really interesting leadership conundrum, because I believe, and it's a belief, so some of you listening will agree, and some of you, I really welcome you disagreeing, but leadership is about being in charge of meaning and purpose, and being responsible for values. And if you think about this, this then is that coherence that I'm talking about, because I can be with what wants to emerge. I can be really, really in touch with my purpose as an organization. And if I'm delivering on that, the state of the organization will then mean the goals get met.
You know, it's lovely to hear you say that, because people who are listening to this will have heard me say on a number of occasions, I'm sure, firstly, that your why is absolutely crucial. It's, if you like, the lighthouse that is that beacon of light that keeps you going in on course, even when things are stormy and that there's rocks and life is difficult. And for me, the values are the equivalent of the ship. Mm-hmm. And so if your values are true and you are behaving in a way that is in line with your values, in an environment that's in line with your values, then the ship is solid and it can withstand even the most terrible storm. However, if it's not, then it will start to leak and it will start to sink. And for me, that those two things, if they're in place and people understand the behaviours that need to be demonstrated on all sides that demonstrate that those values are being met within the organisation, then the organisation is going to be a healthy one.
Yes.
But so often values are something that are put on a piece of paper behind the desk, or they're in a folder somewhere, but actually nobody is living by those values. They're just been a paper exercise, effectively.
Yes, and that's going to create an organisation that is left hemispherically dominant.
Yes.
And people will describe it as heartless or soulless, or it will run into reputational risk because it will defraud customers, or it will hit targets by cheating. Yeah. There's a lot of evidence to suggest in organisations where there's aggressive use of targets, we just fiddle the numbers.
Yes.
Because it's so important to hit the target. You know,
but integrity and trust and respect get compromised in order to meet what's seen as the priority. And the other thing that you just mentioned, and I just want to really reinforce, is that if people chase the profits first and forget that actually what's most important is valuing your people, valuing your customers, living from integrity, compassion and courage, when you do that, the profits come. And they come as a byproduct, if you like, of having a healthy, heart-led company that cares.
Yes, I would agree with that. You know, the profit is merely the applause for doing what you do.
That's
well.
A lovely way of putting it. I like it.
It's, you know, if I put it, my investment analyst hat on,
yeah,
the job of the organisation and the leadership is to make the business more competitive.
Yes.
And, you know, having strong values, having a strong sense of purpose is part of your competitive strategy. It differentiates you from your peer group, because your peer group may do similar products, but it won't have your values and it won't have your sense of purpose. So there's an important strategic dimension to this. And the job of leadership is you're in charge of meaning and purpose in view of deepening your competitive position.
Yeah.
And it's the competitiveness of your position that delivers the profit. Yeah. And I think that what's happening is that leaders are focusing on the things we're talking about, and what management is about, it seems to me, in the current environment, because I think we're in an environment where we're overmanaged and underled.
I would agree with you.
And the danger with management and leadership with a management mindset is you end up managing the scoreboard rather than managing your competitive position.
Yes.
And I think that's why the cheating and the hitting targets, and often those targets are irrelevant in terms of being competitive.
Yes. It's just internally created and driven to make somebody feel as if they're doing a good job, aren't they?
Yeah. And so, and I also think that if you think about the left hemisphere and right hemisphere, and I was, you know, the left hemisphere being rational and analytical, essentially the left hemisphere is anything that IT can do, if you will. And so we've got this situation, I think, with artificial intelligence on a 10, 15 year time frame, that if as humans we're going to remain competitive, we need to be in touch with all of those characteristics of the right hemisphere, those characteristics of creativity, of innovation, of relationship. Those are the things that will differentiate us from AI. I appreciate this may be looking down a long way down the road, but as leaders, we've really got to start thinking about, well, what is it that gives competitive advantage in the environment that we're in? And I do think that it's really important that, you know, we get the most out of our people. And I think a lot of organizations employ a lot of really creative people who really want relationships within the business. And yet I think the businesses are too transaction driven.
I think, you
know, as a result of the targets, rather than relationship driven by virtue of being heart led or values led, or whatever language you wish to use.
If you look at business purely in terms of the level of profitability, and you look at what has been going on over the last few years, it makes no business sense at all to carry on doing what's going on. Over half the prescriptions in the UK alone are for antidepressants. In the year 2019, I think it was, £70 billion a year in that year lost through days because of stress. They think £140 billion lost productivity because of presenteeism, where people are physically present but not firing on all cylinders. So even if you discount the personal cost in terms of mental health, physical health, emotional, spiritual health, the family cost, the cost to children and their lifelong chances, forget those for a moment and just look at the pure figures around productivity and profitability. Any leader who wants success surely has to recognize that what's been going on in the short term may have helped them, but in the long term it is truly destructive, and the bottom line suffers. Loads of other things suffer as well, but it just purely at the level of thinking about production, it makes no sense at all to carry on.
Yes, and I think again it comes back to, if you like, this is a real world example of what I was saying about either or.
Yeah.
You know, so that if an organization is in difficulty, the either or might be, we've either got to cut costs or close a department.
Yeah.
Say. You know, so suddenly you can see that binary decision. Whereas I think the real question is what are all the ways that we can continue to create value, including cutting costs?
Yes.
So I'm not saying the cost base doesn't need attending to, but putting it into a binary doesn't help us, because cutting costs doesn't necessarily create value.
No, in fact, very often in the cutting of costs, you lose disproportionate amount of value in terms of what's being done, because you're becoming inefficient, that you are having a fragmented service and so on. Now, I absolutely accept that people have got to meet their financial commitments, but makes so much more sense to look for a solution that is bigger than, as you say, A or B. And in doing that, it may actually be that what you do is you extend your services and create more jobs or not. I'm not saying that would necessarily be the solution, but it is about finding a solution that is actually much richer, more three-dimensional.
Yes, and I think a lot of that will come back to reconnecting. I mean, Paul Polman did this at Unilever, coming back to what's the original founding purpose of the organisation. What are we about? Yes. What are we in this for? And interestingly, you know, for Unilever, that was interesting given the current pandemic, because their original foundation, if you think about it, making soap, and they made soap because in those days, if you didn't wash your hands, you were dead.
Yes.
Which, of course, has such an echo of the current.
Absolutely, yeah.
But he deliberately went back to that founding purpose.
But his founding purpose, I'm sorry to interrupt, but his founding purpose was not to make soap. And I think a lot of people, when they're talking about purpose, they talk about it as my purpose is to make money. But actually, their founding purpose for Unilever was to keep people safe, to keep people healthy.
Yes.
And, you know, I was talking to somebody a few weeks ago, and they were talking about that they worked in a bank, and they were doing their department did work with startups and very small SMEs. And he said that the shift for him had come with his team when, instead of the purpose being how many accounts can we sign up, was when he started to recognize that the purpose was about supporting people to create a better life for them in terms of the client, the customer, whatever you want to call it. And once his team recognized that they were making a fundamental difference in the life chances of their clients, there was a sea change within the department, which meant that they went from a struggling department that was constantly, you know, doing badly to one that was absolutely thriving. Not only did that come, but it came through the fact that the relationships between the staff and the people that they dealt with were on a very different basis. Not about, I want your account and then goodbye, but how can I help you succeed in business? How can we support you, not just with money, but how can we support you and how can we help you become more successful? And things changed hugely.
Yes, and I think that's what we're talking about, or the language I'm using around coherence.
Yes.
Because that's really connecting with the purpose.
Yeah.
And it's doing something that's beyond you.
Yes.
And it's beyond profit. And you're so right, is that, you know, this is why I say the money then flows after you've fulfilled that purpose. And I think you refer to all of the kind of the health issues, stress issues related to the way organisations are run currently. I think when you've articulated, as they did, a very precise sense of purpose, I think you create belonging. And I think it's such a fundamental human need that, again, I think for leaders, how can you create belonging, you know, create an architecture of belonging within your organisation so people are seen, recognised for what they bring, psychological safety is there so that they can think and they can dissent, you know, rather than this conformity that everybody seems to want. You know, if you've got very bright, creative people, if you create a safe environment, you will get the best out of them.
Isn't it interesting, though, how many of the big corporates go and get the cream of the graduates because they, one would assume, want creative thinkers, people who are hungry and enthusiastic, and then put them into a box which says you have to do things exactly as it has been done before. There is no chance of innovation, creativity. And you see those people 5, 10, 15, 20 years completely burnt out.
Hmm. Yeah, because Again, that's that reliance on the left hemisphere, isn't it? The same patterns, the same processes, you know. Whereas I think we're talking about, given the complexity and ambiguity around us, we need to innovate. We need to be able to identify, you know, in the example you gave, how are the needs of my clients changing as a result of this?
Yes.
You know, and being in touch with that and being present to that. And that's something the left hemisphere can't do. It can't be present with the person. Right. And I think, you know, leadership to me and leadership presence is just, you can just tell when a leader is present, yeah, you know, because it shows up in a sort of an embodied way. And of course, we can only be embodied if we've got this coherence between our two hemispheres, but also we're in touch with our heart brain and our gut brain.
Because it's important, isn't it, that we would take the best of our left brain. We do need to analyze, we do need to be logical and so on. But it's when that dominates that there is a problem. So yes. My question to you is, you know, people are listening to this thinking, ooh, I can recognize myself as a left brain dominant thinker. And I can see the potential of more right brain. But have you got any suggestions, any techniques that people can use to develop, not only perhaps develop their right brain, but then to develop the cohesion?
Yes, I mean, it's one of these things that's quite miraculous and simple. Okay. And the key is to slow down. Because one of the characteristics of the left hemisphere, particularly if it's under stress or we get into that problem state we were referring to, our brain tends to speed up. And I suspect a number of you will be familiar with that. You know, it's kind of, it's racing away. And, you know, somebody says, you know, please do this. You say, well, I haven't got time. Do you realize how busy, you know, that indication, but just notice as I'm doing this and noticing as I'm getting more stressed, and I'm getting more in my head. Just notice where my breathing is going. My breathing is too high.
Yeah.
And one of the key things, I think in a business setting and in coaching, for those of you who are coaches, there's a wonderful acronym called BLIP, which stands for Breathing Level Indicates Permission. Breathing Level Indicates Permission. So if I'm breathing up here, you haven't got permission to tell me anything useful or ask me anything important because I'm too stressed.
You can't take it on board.
So what's the job of the leader then? Is to show up with coherence and to get maximum permission by their breathing being as low as possible.
So that low, you're talking about breathing. I talk about breathing right down to your knees. So that it,
yes.
And nobody's suggesting that your lungs go down to your knees, but in that intention, then you fully open up your lungs.
And you just slow things down, and it can take as little as 2 minutes. And one of the best ways of doing this is you can either breathe into your heart space or you can breathe into your gut space. I don't mind which, but you do it for an equal count. So you breathe in for a count of five, if that's comfortable for you, and out for a count of five. And what this does is it actually settles the vagus nerve.
Okay.
The nerve that links the gut brain, the heart brain, and the right hemisphere, that relaxes as you slow your breathing down.
Yeah.
And what coherence allows you to do is then just get the breathing down. Breathing at that regular in and out breath creates coherence, which is a state of what I would call relaxed alertness.
Yeah.
You know, where you're really relaxed and you're ready to go. And it's that crucial thing for leadership, I believe, that it's looking after your own state.
Yes.
And being in charge of that, you know, and leading your inner team, your, excuse me, your inner team of heart and gut brain and your vagus nerve, taking responsibility for those before you take responsibility for others. Excuse me.
Which those of you who are listening will know that the very, very heart of this program is that you are the person, you are at the core of this. You have to manage and lead yourself first, and then you model that for other people. Where at the moment, I think so many people think that leading is all about out there, rather than doing the deep work yourself.
Yeah, so this is the deep work. And this is very simple work, but it is about reconnecting you with your breath.
Yeah.
And the reconnection with the breath gets us back into the body. And the body is where the decisions are made, really. The left hemisphere rationalizes what the body knows. So we need to have a better relationship with our body.
Yeah.
And we need to tune in. If we've got a big decision to make, you know, what I'm encouraging is be in a state of coherence before that decision is taken.
It's interesting. If you listen to Warren Buffett, one, and Richard Branson, another, they talk about using their intuition. And there's a big unit in this program about listening to your intuition, which I think it's all about getting quiet and being prepared to go inwards. Warren Buffett talks about listening to his gut, and that early on in his career, he ignored what his gut was telling him. And on that occasion, it cost him £1 billion, which for me is like monopoly money, really.
Yes.
And Richard Branson talks the same. He says about using data, but then using his intuition to ask the questions, have I got enough data? Have I got enough of the right sort of data? Do I need to do anything else? Or am I in a position where I can make a decision that's based on the best potential information that's out there? And then listen to his inner voice, which says, you've listened to all of that, you've looked at the data, now what feels right? And for me, and this is a very personal thing, when something feels right, there's a lightness to it internally. It feels light and airy. When something feels wrong, I get that heavy sense in my gut that says, not sure about this. And I can honestly say that when I've listened to it, things have gone really well. And on those few occasions when I have ignored it, I have wished very much that I didn't.
Exactly. And that's what we're really talking about, is how do you maintain? And this is, I think, quite a deep spiritual question.
Yeah.
How do you maintain the relationship with your own heart? Because
it's a question, though, isn't it?
It's an important question, isn't it? But how often do you check in with it? Because this is where your values sit.
Mm-hmm.
This is where your emotional processing manifests.
Yeah.
This is what is all about your relatedness with others.
Yes.
So if you're not tuned in here, you know, these are all leadership issues, values, relationships.
Absolutely. At the very heart.
Exactly.
Unintentional. At the very heart of it, isn't it?
Yeah. And so what's the relationship? And what I'm encouraging is this coherent breathing, is if you breathe into your heart center and just be with it.
Yeah.
Similarly with the gut. Because what we're trying to say here is what the coherence between left and right hemisphere is, I would call horizontal coherence. And then you've got a vertical coherence, which the heart contributes all it knows, the wisdom of the heart, the importance of your values. And then your gut, with all of its courage, its ability to make action in the world, its ability to take you forward, that traction, that way of being in the world, requires your gut brain to be engaged. And it's making sure that each of these, this inner team I referred to earlier, that this inner team is all involved, are all involved. And so, you know, because if you think about procrastination, is the procrastination because your heart's not in it, in which case don't do it?
Yeah.
Or is the procrastination because your gut is not involved and there isn't just a, you know, you really, your heart wants you to do it, but there isn't enough momentum and will in the gut to be engaged? See, those, so the same issue, procrastination, two very different solutions depending upon the intelligence from the body. So I think I'm just offering a slightly more expanded view, if I may, of intuition. It's a kind of ensuring that the right hemisphere is involved, the heart's got its say, and the gut is involved, because the gut is where the action will then take place.
Really, really interesting. We're going to draw this to a close now. So I suppose my question to you, my penultimate question is, given what we're our aim today is to give people a real flavour of cohesion between left and right brain, is there anything that you think that we haven't talked about that we need to talk about before we finish today?
The one thing I would emphasise is this capacity of the right hemisphere to help you with complexity and ambiguity.
Yeah, going to be so it is so important, isn't it? But never more so than at a time that we have at the moment.
Yeah, so the capacity to be present with it and not try and change it.
Yeah.
That, I think, is just a great capacity. And we have far more resources in our body than our left hemisphere. But the thing is the left hemisphere believes it can go it alone.
Yeah.
And those moments when we're caught in our ego and we're not slowing down is when we need to slow down more. But it's really important, because I think everyone's working so hard. And when I left finance and left the city, one of the things that really struck me was that everyone was working too hard and thinking too little. And I think leadership is really creating spaces in which, you know, we can think and think coherently, drawing on both hemispheres. And leaders have a responsibility to create a state and conditions, because otherwise the decision-making we've seen over the last decade, if you like, 20 years, if you want to take things like Enron, the great financial crash, austerity, these are all decisions. All I'm suggesting is that the decisions weren't coherent.
Yeah. And of course, we've lived through the impact of that,
yeah,
and are living through the impact of that. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. Always have a fascinating conversation with you. And I hope those of you that are listening, you're going to think about your own practices. And some of these just very simple things, like taking time to just be, to breathe, to take an opportunity to listen in to that heart center, because it's got so much to offer you, and so many people don't even know that it does anything other than just pump blood around them, and it's really important. So Michael, where can people get hold of you if they want to find out more?
The best thing to do is get in touch with me at michael@marketmatters, all one word, marketmatters.co.uk.
And we'll make sure that that's in the show notes. So thanks for joining me. Hope you're enjoying the programme. And I shall be inviting Michael to talk about some of the other things that he's an expert in. I think we've talked about Enneagrams and so on. I'm looking forward to that. So thanks again, and we'll see you soon.
If you're a businesswoman who is overwhelmed or suffering from imposter syndrome, who is tired of having one disastrous relationship after another, or who finds it hard just to say no, well, it's time to take care of you. You get the best out of life by contacting Gina Gardner, relationship coach and best-selling author and motivational speaker. Just visit genuinely-you.com, or you can email Gina directly at gina@genuinely-you.com. Take action now. Start to thrive rather than simply survive. Imagine being a highly successful, enlightened leader who is in complete alignment with your best self, who makes a positive difference on a daily basis. Let me introduce Gina Gardner, an expert in developing transformational leadership with over 30 years of experience. Gina has developed a unique and unrivaled approach to help you step into your genuine power to become an enlightened leader. And when you do, amazing things happen. Go to enlightened leadership.co or email Gina at gina@genuinely-you.com.
Hello there, and welcome back. For those of you who are familiar with this show, you will know that Rachel and I, Rachel Davidson and I, do a genuine chat as the second half of the show. For those of you who are not familiar, Rachel Davidson is a number one international best-selling author. She has written an amazing trilogy of spiritual novels. The three novels are called...
The trilogy name is Beyond Veils. And the first book is The Point of Me, second book is The Truth of Her, and the third book is The Hope of Us.
Great books, I can really recommend them. I too am an international best-selling author, and it's interesting for me because the theme today is around communication. And of course, writing books is a very important form of communication. Why do I choose this? Well, because communication between people is incredibly important at every level in terms of relationships and so on. But I want to separate the two themes of communicating with others mm-hmm. and the communication we have with ourselves, mm-hmm. because in many ways, the communication we have with ourselves is probably the more important and at times the more destructive. Mm-hmm. But let's start with communicating with other people. Now, there's done a lot of research around communication, and if you're talking about face-to-face communication, and these days it's generally through Zoom or Skype, yeah. They talk about, you know, between 50 and 60% of our communication is not verbal. It's our body language, the how we stand, the how we hold ourselves, the how our face is arranged, whether we're smiling or frowning.
Yeah.
And then tonality is just over 30%. And so the words that we use are actually the smallest percentage. And even when we're on the phone and we can't be seen, rather than body language and words being swapped over, which is what most people think, actually the tonality then takes on the greater importance. But words are still the least important of what's being said. And I find it quite interesting how many people use body language in a very passive aggressive way, that the words that they are saying are quite innocuous in terms of their meaning, but because they are delivered with a body language which is has that edge to it, that's giving a very different message, that people will take the body language message rather than the word message in terms of the meaning they make of it.
Well, that's because it's truer. That you missed out one of the other aspects, which isn't often talked about in general body communication speak, is that the energetic body.
I was going to come on to that, but it's off you go.
It's kind of linked, isn't it? Because, you know, you can't do body language without moving your energy. And the fact, you know, we use a lot of language that talks about our energetic body, about, you know, oh, I've got the weight of the world on my shoulders, or, you know, all this sort of phraseology that we do, which is redolent of how our aura, our energetic body is feeling. The best people to watch, I think, in terms of communication, because I do think as humans, we're far too fixated on words. And I speak as a writer saying this, that words is part of the intellectual, you know, frontal cortex of the brain. And it's something that we've evolved into doing, and we value our language and our ability to verbally communicate. We value it very highly, don't we? But if you actually look at how animals communicate, then they have the ability to understand you much better without any language. If you look at somebody like the dog whisperer, Cesar Millan, He can communicate with all sorts of species across the range. He is a bit of a Dr. Dolittle in that sense, but not without the Disneyfication of it. And he does it just simply by understanding his energetic body and understanding what an intent can mean in the world, and how you, you know, place yourself. And it's certainly true that no dog will ever, you know, be fooled by you. No animal will. You can't go up and pretend to be, you know, the big I am with a dog.
No.
It doesn't care, because, you know, you're justifying the big I am on human concepts such as money and status and blah. But B, if you're not the big I am, if you're not actually being truthful, the dog will understand it.
Yes.
The dog will interpret that as an imbalanced, yeah? So, and no matter what we think, you know, whether you're truly attuned to it, and some of the spiritual masters in the world are highly attuned to it, but most of us are not. Most of us just wander around doing all of this conscious thought and not paying too much attention to what we might refer as gut instinct. But we all get it. We all understand when somebody is telling us lies, big or small. Yeah, we all understand it because we can feel their intention. And I, you know, it's interesting to me that now that we're doing so much more remote communication, it's interesting to me, because I'm not knowledgeable enough on the subject, whether that energetic body can transmit through. Obviously, you're sat there listening to the tone of my voice, the words I'm using. You can see, because we're on video too, the position of my shoulders and my head and so on and so forth. But you can't really see what I'm doing with my hands. You can't see how I'm, you know, placing my legs. You can't see my whole body thing. And you, I don't know, can you feel my energetic intention around the communication? I think that's the danger we get into.
If you tune into it, I mean, I do a lot of coaching before Zoom and Skype. It was always on the telephone. So I didn't see the body language at all. And one of the things that struck me is how, let's, silences have a very different quality.
Yeah, yeah. Hmm.
And I believe that the quality of those silences was picking up the energetic intention, energetic status, if you like. Because one might argue that a silence is a silence. It's a complete absence of noise. Therefore, they're all the same. But the reality is that if you're tuning in, they're different. But I think it's the issue is, are you tuning in?
Now, you see, I like that. Again, not because of any personal experience of it or knowledge in any way, but of course, I do know people who perform remote healing and have reported back, you know, I was going to use the word miraculous, but that's lazy of me, but, you know, definite improvements, definite
yes
switches, yeah? And that's from acting in a very remote way. So my belief is that our energetic bodies can extend anywhere within the world at any time if yes we have sufficient sort of, you know, practice and discipline and training in order to really sort of achieve it. But even actually, the most basic sort of non-spiritual person can send a very powerful intention with, you know, if they think it and have that very powerful feeling in the moment, then that will go around the globe too. I think.
Let me give you a very simple example. I was working with a client, it's a mum and a daughter, last night.
Mm-hmm.
And in reality, the daughter's the client, but the mum, the two of them are working together.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the problems for the young lady is that she has symptoms of OCD. She's very, very anxious. Yeah. And I taught her the principle of archetypes.
Yeah.
Now, for those who are watching or listening and not familiar with that expression, it is where a group of people have similar characteristics. So one would like to think that a mother was nurturing, caring, compassionate, where mm-hmm a serial killer would be seen as cold and cruel and calculating.
Mm-hmm.
And I teach a couple of assertive body stances, if you like, but it all starts with the intention in your head. And the first one is that of a medieval royal. Now, for those of you that are in the States, if you were a medieval royal, you were all powerful. And if you spoke, the expectation is that everybody would listen. And if they didn't, then it was off to the Tower of London and off with your head. And so there is an intention that I will be listened to without saying a word. And so the stance is very upright, shoulders back, head up, as imagined a golden cord just pulling you up. feet slightly apart because royals spend a lot of time standing and they want to feel really grounded and settled. But the intention is, I will be listened to. And what I find fascinating, because I've taught, the other one is to do a warrior, but a warrior not from the point of being aggressive, but just on guard saying, and the message that's going out is, don't even think about messing with me. And they, again, very similar, but the stance is one foot forward, but the upper body the same. Now, I've taught this to thousands of people, and I use it myself. Interestingly, if you go into a bar when you can, and there's a big, big queue, and you go put yourself into your medieval king or queen stance or your warrior stance, non-aggressive, remember assertive, interestingly, the bar person will always notice you and you'll get served quickly. If you use that stance when you're going to take something back into a shop, you'll find that the shopkeeper never, ever questions. That you go into an interview with this. Remember, it's assertive, no sign of aggression. Then people that I've taught this to, not just this, but other things, have generally got the job. Why? Because the energetic message that they're sending out is, my intention is that I believe you will listen to me, I'm worth listening to, that I have a level of significance that you will notice that I am here and you will respond accordingly.
That Susan Milan talks about that is in terms of calm assertiveness, and that is the leader. That is what we all, even the giant apes such as we are, we all feel comfortable around calm assertiveness.
Yeah.
Because we just feel reassured that, oh, this person's got it.
Yeah.
So if you can embody that energy.
And the reason I teach the archetypes is it's a very simple way of getting people to feel what it feels like to be assertive, even if they are not feeling confident.
Yeah.
And if you practice it, I mean, it's like one of these things, the more you do it, the more it becomes your natural way of being. And to start with, I teach it standing up. But of course, once you've got the understanding of how it feels, you can be sitting down or even lying down, and you will still have that energy being communicated to other people.
Yeah.
And the intention that is in your head is so important. If you believe you won't be listened to, you won't be listened to. So when I was the head teacher or principal of a large school, you know, students would say, why is it you can stand in front of the whole school and you just stand there and you just slightly clear your throat and everybody sits up and is waiting, and I could dance naked and nobody would notice? And the reality is, I expect to be listened to, and people recognize that I expected to be listened to. Whereas the student had no confidence that anybody was going to listen to them. So the body language, the energetic signal communication that came from that was very different.
Yeah.
And so when we talk about communication, I think, you know, it's really important that the intention that you set, whether you are speaking or writing, or even communicating through music or drawing or whatever your form of communication is, think about your intention. Think about the energetic message that you're giving out there. And when you are consciously doing that in a constructive and positive way, you'll find that things do change. The other thing I would say is that this isn't just about communication with other people. You know, the internal communication we have with ourselves is not about posture, but it is about intention. And, you know, we think about other people hurting us with their words, or lack of them for that matter. But actually, there's nothing that anybody can say to us that is as damaging as the things that we say to ourselves. And so I think it's really important that you set the intention that you will treat yourself as a good friend. No better, no worse. But ultimately, if you're beating yourself up and telling yourself how useless you are, that's not only not true, but it's not helpful, and ultimately becomes incredibly destructive.
I was having to coach my daughter yesterday, first day back in whatever number lockdown we are in the UK. and so having to do homeschooling, and she had her worst subject first thing, so she wasn't very keen, and she was convinced that she was failing. And I said to her, you know, you're the only one in the world that thinks you're failing, and you're the only one who tells you yourself that you're failing. Carried on. And then I said, right, you know, there's just going to be a rule going forward that for every time you say out loud, I'm a failure, I'm this, we're going to have to think of three things where you're not failing, and we're going to have to state those out loud. And if you can't be bothered to do the positive side of it, then don't do the negative side, because that's the rule now. For every one negative thought, you have to think of three positive ones and state them out loud. And if she doesn't do that, I'll get her to write them down, because that'll make it more hassly. And then maybe she might just realise that, you know, I mean, it's not that you can ever banish negative thoughts. It's not that you can ever get rid of that side of you. It's just you've got to acknowledge that they're just clouds upon a sky. And the black ones, you just need to hurry along a bit quicker. And the sunny, fluffy ones, you can sit with and enjoy a bit more. But, you know, they're just clouds on a sky.
For the most part, they are a story. They're an illusion that we're making up. And those illusions become more and more concrete the more that we do it. Yeah. And so it's so important that we challenge those negative beliefs. They're there for a reason. And if they're there to motivate you to do better, well, great. But if they're having the opposite effect, then it really is something you need to deal with.
The other thing I was told when I was young, about being too self-critical was if you wouldn't have the guts to go up and say it to a stranger in the street, then you shouldn't say it to yourself.
I think that's a really good rule of thumb. And I would say that the criteria that you use to judge other people should be the same criteria that you use to judge yourself. But many people have criteria which are so much more draconian for themselves, so much more difficult to meet, and as soon as they meet them, then they create another condition in order to feel bad and actually stay in that victim place, which is a whole nother theme that we will cover on another show. So we're drawing to a close. I want you to think about over the next few weeks, what is the what energy are you communicating to other people? Are you communicating something which is calm, assertive? And what's the impact of that? If you're not, try the archetypes, that of medieval royal or of warrior who is on guard. Don't mess with me. But remember, there's no edge to it. There's no aggression to it. Mm. It's just taking that stance that you are in a situation where people will listen and will notice you because you have that sense of confidence and calm. And if you haven't got it to start with, fake it till you make it, because the more you practice it, the easier it will become. Now, we'd love to hear from you. Please email us at gina@genuinely-and-the-word-you.com. You'll find our books on Amazon, Beyond Veil, the trilogy with Rachel's, all my books you'll find on Amazon under Gina Gardner. Please subscribe to the YouTube Genuinely You channel. And what we want for you is for you to take charge of your own life. Start with the energetic communication that you have with yourself and with other people. So thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time. Take care now. Bye-bye.